Welcome to another Inspiring That Optimism Man podcast. Today, I've got the privilege of introducing Nick Tassler, author of The Year of Wonders, Embrace Change, Grow Faster, Win Bigger. It's a book that seamlessly blends practical wisdom with powerful storytelling. For me, what makes Nick's perspective so compelling is the originality of his agile optimism. Have a listen to where he shares his evolution from a youthful contrarian, often critiquing the status quo and the older generation, to embracing what he calls agile optimism, a mindset that's not about ignoring challenges but facing them head on with creativity, resilience, and absurd positivity. He captures this beautifully, so listen up for this when he says, "Let's not gloss over the realities or the challenges, but let's be absurdly optimistic about how we can handle them and make something out of them." In our conversation, Nick will guide us through the transformative power of agile optimism, his four laws of navigating change, and his practical framework, the five W's to turn life's uncertainties into growth opportunities. So, if, like the rest of us, you've ever wondered how to face life's unpredictability with grace and confidence, this conversation's for you. And let's dive in. Welcome, Nick. You're joining us from Puerto Rico, and I'm here in Australia's Port Melbourne during the height of summer, so we're in two patches of paradise.
Yes, we are.
And look, it's great to have you on That Optimism Man podcast and to explore optimism, your new book. And I've been listening to it on Audible. I can commend it to people. You've got such an easy reading style. And we're going to talk about the role of optimism in navigating life's opportunities. But firstly, everyone who visits the Center for Optimism gets this question, Nick. What makes you optimistic? Is your optimism shaped by your life experiences, your faith, your mindset, the facts, or the positive people around you?
Yes. Is that a good enough answer? No.
It's a good answer.
I think it's all those things. And I'll say, you know, as I think about my life journey, I can't say that I've always been an optimist. And what I mean by that is I think probably I'm not alone here, but I think lots of people like me, and say you're kind of late teens, early 20s, it's this weird state, because on the one hand, you have this kind of almost like anything is possible, naive sort of idealism. But on the other hand, this like cynicism about how all the older people have gotten it wrong and they're screwing up our country and our life. And, you know, the older generation needs to get out of the way. I kind of sort of call that my Holden Caulfield stage, for any classic literature readers there. So I think there was a long time in my life where I really prided myself on being a contrarian. And oftentimes that came across as cynicism. And so I think, you know, and how I ended up there, I don't really know. I think probably if I look at it through the lens of a psychologist, is it was sort of socially profitable to be that contrarian, to always be the one to point out the thing that nobody else is talking about, right? And unfortunately, a lot of times that looks like cynicism. But I always kind of felt like, I guess this is where the closet optimist in me was sort of like finding its way out, was that oftentimes I was taking a contrarian view and saying, no, let's not gloss over the realities of the situation. Let's not gloss over the real challenges, but let's be absurdly optimistic about how we can handle them, about how we can make something out of them. And I would say, you know, two and a half decades later, that's the part of me that really kind of blossomed, I guess, philosophically.
I was reading a eulogy to a 108-year-old lady who died in New Zealand this week, and she's an optimist. And her son said her great tribute was that she was an optimist. And I think the science actually says life experience makes us more optimistic. There was a 106-year-old lady who died in Australia a couple of years ago, and she said, "I never worry about yesterday because I can't change it. And whatever I do today, the sun is still going to rise tomorrow. So that notion of things are going to turn out, the Harvard definition of optimism, that notion that good things will happen and that things will work out in the end. And I think John Lennon has attributed the follow-up, which is, if it hasn't worked out, it's not the end.
Interesting. I've never heard that. That's a John Lennon quote, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's attributed to a number of people, but he certainly said it as well. But there's a notion of, and you go back, for instance, to Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning and his addendum, Tragic Optimism, that optimism is formed in struggle and it's formed in hardship. And, it's not the stuff that's built in good times, it's the stuff that's built in hard times.
Absolutely. And I think if we all reflect honestly on our own life experience, we find that to be true. Now, I can say, I think if we look at sort of the happiness research over the lifespan, which I'm sure you're aware of, there is this point typically for people in their 50s and 60s where in a weird way, we kind of like let go of all the things that we thought we had to have that kind of made us maybe pessimistic and feeling like we kind of get the short end of the stick and whatever. And you kind of settle into, and I use that term settling in a very positive way here, settle into this wise understanding of the way that the world works and that no, not every day is flowers and puppy dogs, but ultimately, the arc bends positive, right?
I like that idea. The year before last, I got contacted by an organization called the Art and Science of Joy. And we did a partnership over a year. And I must confess, I now have a garden that has a flower in it all the year, roses and the like. And I do stop and smell the roses every time I walk out of my front door. That notion of joy in every day sort of helps to lift my optimism. And I often use the question with people. I don't, Australian, a lot of Australians use the expression, G'day, how are you? To which the answer is normally not bad or not too bad. So it takes you nowhere. So I, in fact, ask a question, which is, what's been the best thing in your day? And that sort of
Oh, that's great.
notion of merging contentment, happiness, joy, really works for me because most people just sort of stop and but what is this question this man's asking me? He wants me to think in my greeting.
Right. Well, you've flipped the script on them, right? And I like that. I might have to steal that from you, but with attribution, of course. But what I like about it is it also reflects the idea that every day has some good things and it has some not so good things. And the real difference between optimism and pessimism is not like a naivete or realism. It's like which of those pieces are you choosing to focus on, period.
Anyway, you
And
can use it. Try it for a week. Normally, that's my prescription to people. And there's a lady in my supermarket who said, "You're my favorite customer because you lift me every time you come." Although sometimes at 7 in the morning, she says, "It's a bit early to share that with you." Now,
so
you've
what
got
is
a new book, which I love the title of, Your Year of Wonders. Embrace change, grow faster, win bigger. You've described it as a fun and fascinating airplane read. I, of course, have listened to it on Audible, and I can commend that to people because your voice is very listenable. So
Thank you.
I've enjoyed listening to it on Audible. I've got a copy next to me here on Kindle. So really accessible. So tell me about it. This is the distillation of a lifetime of thinking.
So well, it's funny. So I'll try not to go too far back in my life history, but it's sort of what's interesting is it's actually my fifth book. But there was like a 8 year lapse there where I felt like I had said everything that I needed to say. So there was a span between my time my first book got published in 2008 and 2017, where it was like every 2 years. And as soon as I would finish one, I knew exactly what I was going to write about next. And in the last one that came out in 2007, I kind of had this moment where it was like, that's sort of everything I've been burning to say. And really what happened, where the genesis of this one, I would say, began with the pandemic. And it was kind of like, for me and all of us, it was this period of reflection, right? In my last book, it was called Ricochet: What to Do When Change Happens to You. Okay. And the point of that book was, and I mentioned Viktor Frankl in there, and I talk about research on resilience and kind of like dealing with change and enduring change. And the thing that really struck me is, starting with the pandemic, is I kind of took that idea and it started to go off on a different path, where I started thinking, wait a second, if all we're doing is enduring the change, if we're just surviving it, if we're just dealing with it, we're really selling ourselves short, because moments, periods of change are such fertile ground for insight, for development, for strength, you know, as you say. And of course, Frankl, like you mentioned, like he said, that's where optimism is cultivated. And I think it's because we see the world from this totally different perspective. And if you look at it in spiritual terms, oftentimes you can look at it as periods of change, sometimes even traumatic change. They're what mystics might call a thin place, where the boundary between us and sort of the other world is thinner than it normally is. And then I think you can look at neuroscience research and say, yeah, that makes sense. Like, our brain switches gears when we have this period of change. And so all of a sudden, this idea of the Year of Wonders, which again, the title itself came from something I stumbled onto during the pandemic about Isaac Newton and how the Great Plague of 1665 was his, he always referred to it as his Year of Wonders. That was the year when the apocryphal story of him, you know, having an apple drop on his head, maybe didn't happen, and how he kind of discovered the idea of gravity, the force of gravity, started in that Year of Wonders. And that really kind of gave way to all the things I had been observing and researching about, yeah, this other side of change, that it really can be more than something we survive. It can be this wonder-filled experience.
And I love that word, wonder. And you know, of course, what drew me to your book is your wonderful concept of agile optimism. And it's a fascinating concept. So you've described it as, you can tell I've read your book, expecting insights on the way to outcomes, pursuing this deal will open a door I didn't see before, running that race will build important new muscles, launching this product will teach us invaluable lessons about what our customers really want. Now, I've got a list of optimism superpowers. Agile optimism was not one of them. And now, of course, it is. Do you want to tell people what is agile optimism? And, you know, like, people are driven mad by agile meetings. You know, the fast meeting's a good meeting. So how can we make agile optimism a part of our lives?
Yeah, great question, Victor. So the whole point of agile optimism, I think the best way to understand it is to contrast it with fragile optimism. And so fragile optimism, I think, is the brand or breed of optimism that attracts scorn, right? It's the thing that pessimists are able to latch onto and say, oh, look at this crazy optimist, so naive, so silly, so ignorant. You know, they were so optimistic that they were going to get that deal, they were going to win that race, and look what happened. They didn't, right? And so it opens the door. When we hang our optimism or our whatever, our sense of identity, anything, on an outcome, we're kind of treading on slippery ground, right? But it doesn't mean that we have to give in to the alternative, which is pessimism, right? That's not the only alternative. So rather than saying, I know that this exact great thing is going to happen, which is what I call fragile optimism, and it feels really empowering in the moment until things don't go as planned, and then that great empowering optimism it shatters into a million little pieces, hence fragile. So agile optimism is still a way of looking at the future, looking at the uncertainty and saying, I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but what I can guarantee is I'm going to have an insight by pursuing this path. Somewhere along the way, maybe when I least expect it, I'm going to have an insight. I'm going to find something that's going to point the way to the next step in the process. And then when I get there, I'm going to have another insight that's going to point the way. And so it's still this way of looking at the future with this like excited curiosity, without hinging too much of our satisfaction on things we can't control.
It's interesting. I have a friend, John Hagel. I don't know if you've ever come across John, but he written many books. He was the head of the Deloitte Center for the Edge. His most recent book is The Journey Beyond Fear. And of
Okay.
course, he's a friend of mine, so there's a chapter on optimism. But he also thinks what he talks about is the explorer's journey. So asking good questions, but taking it beyond that, almost to create new knowledge and new wisdom as a result of asking questions. And I resonate with the principles of appreciative inquiry, that instead of the but, the and is
Right.
the thing I love in a question. And I'm probably the only fan of the 1973 version of the film Lost Horizon with the music of Burt Bacharach, but there's a song in there called Answer, Question Me and Answer. And it's question me and answer, right or wrong. You can answer with a question, right or wrong. Even though your answer may be wrong, your question may be right. So this notion of curiosity and exploration and inquiry, which is fostering optimism and growth, it sounds to me like you and John are blood brothers, and I'm likely to be an acolyte of both of you.
And possibly our third brother. Yeah, so I do think there is definitely an element of that curiosity. So it's like it's how can we have that kind of conviction, that empowered conviction that optimism gives us, right? That makes us unafraid of the future and yet still be open to things might happen that I didn't plan. Things might happen that I don't understand at this moment, but I'm excited for them because I know that some way or another they can be leveraged for the good of me, for the good of our team, for the good of our company. And so this is where the agile part comes in. So it's saying, yes, we are optimistic about the future. We've got a great strategy, we've got a great plan, and we're really bought into it, but we're kind of loose and nimble, and we're not holding it so tight that we're like sucking the life out of all the wonder and curiosity and possibilities that might be in store for us that we can't plan right now, that can't be part of our strategy because we just don't know.
I had two great examples in my life. My maternal grandmother was sent to the Gulag by the Soviets and survived in a camp, where literally hundreds of thousands of people died. And yet she said to me, I'm going to outlive communism. And when she
Wow.
joined hands with the million people across the Baltics, in
Wow.
the end, it came true. She outlived the Soviet Union and Lithuania became a democratic country, and these days, of course, a leader in NATO. And then my mum was a refugee twice, widowed twice, and she found yoga, and she spent 50 years exploring yoga and was still teaching at the age of 92. So for me, that notion of, yeah, shit happens,
Yeah.
but keep going, and something will turn up. Sort of, it's four generations of family, I think, with that sort of ethos.
It's really fascinating, Victor. And what it reminds me of is as you mentioned your grandmother, well, your whole family really is one of Frankl's favorite, one of my favorite notions of his, this contrast between we are never free from fate, from change, from undesirable things happening to us, but we are always free to decide our response, right? And you can't really think of, I can't think of a more liberating view on the world than that right there. So Optimism, specifically my brand of what I call agile optimism, is very much in line with that idea of we're accepting the fact that something might happen that we didn't expect and or want, but we are clinging to this freedom to make something out of it, to decide our response to it, to make something good. And in your grandmother's case, that yeah, I didn't obviously she didn't want to get sent to the gulags. She didn't want to have these things happen, but she decided I'm going to use this as my, my banner and my launch pad to say I'm going to survive communism, right? That's really powerful.
So for me, that maternal and paternal line. But coming back to your agile optimism, you have four laws of agile optimism, almost Newtonian, isn't it? Falling apples are seasonal. Apples need time to grow. That is powerful, isn't it? Like optimism, apples need time to grow. Apples don't fall far from the tree. And we've both got 17-year-old kids, and we're looking out for their future. And falling apples are predictably unpredictable. Do you want to tell us about those laws? I just love them.
Yeah, that's great. So falling apples are seasonal, okay? And so basically, this is kind of a nod to the neuroscience behind this idea that when we find ourselves in this period of change, when the unexpected happens, our brain shifts gears, and we kind of rely on parts of our brain that maybe are dormant during normal times when things are routine and stable and the world is predictable. And then all of a sudden, something happens. It could be I don't know, a pandemic. It could be a job change. It could be a new leader that now you're responsible to. And whatever it is, whatever form it takes, all of a sudden our brain shifts gears. And so this notion that, we can spot falling apples, there are times in our life, and I kind of called it a thin place earlier. It's in these thin place seasons when we are most likely to have these insights. And what I found so fascinating about the research and then kind of like cross-referencing it with my own experience is it's like oftentimes these insights, they're not about, it doesn't necessarily have to be you go travel somewhere and you go to some place you've never been. Often it's the thing that's been right outside our front door for months, if not years, that all of a sudden we see with a whole new lens because of this shift in the way our brain is operating, and the way it's trying to make sense of this world that suddenly doesn't make as much sense as it did a day ago. Right. And so that's why falling apples are seasonal. And what I love about it, I think the empowering thing about it is it's usually the seasons that we least want is falling apple season, right? It's the one that's the most disruptive. That's the prime time for the greatest insight.
Brilliant, brilliant. And I do like that. And then you in that chapter on optimism, you write about your son and your
Yes.
basketball career, and you introduce the concept, I think it's five W's, although I wrote it down as four W's because it's so cleverly constructed. Win, worry, wonder, work, win. I find
Right.
that a compelling framework. Do you want to tell us more about it?
Yeah, of course. So you're right that there's actually only four words there, but I like to do the win twice
Well, when I was
because
looking at my notes just before you joined me, I'm looking at I've written four, but there's five.
I mean, Nick is a great thinker, not such a good counter, is what you were thinking, right? but so what it means here, and the reason I opted with five is because I think it's so important to bookend the process with a win to start and a win to end. And so basically, what it means is the process of growth usually begins with a win. It's something. It's some little victory. So maybe we landed the sale, we landed the deal. Maybe we got the job, we got the promotion. In my son's case, maybe it was I was talking specifically like a skill development. So he was a volleyball player and he had to switch positions. And so the win for him was all of a sudden in this new position, he sees, oh wait, I actually can do this. So he hits the ball the right way, and it kind of gives him hope that, you know what, I've got a future here. Okay. And so that's where the win comes in. But then immediately after we make the sale or get the promotion, and I say immediately, often I feel like it is almost within moments, we get really excited, and then it's like, oh crap, now I have to deliver. Now I just sold this customer on this thing, and boy, did I oversell it. Can I actually deliver what I just told them that
You
they're
and me
supposed
as optimism salesmen.
to get? That's right. That's right. You know, so all of a sudden that win then is followed by worry. Okay. And now, because we have to deliver, right? Now we have to make good on the promise. But fortunately, that worry doesn't last for that long because we're eventually going to have a wonder, right? In line with agile optimism, we are going to have an insight because of that worry, I would argue, not in spite of that worry. It's because of it. Again, our brain switches tracks, and now we have a wonder. All of a sudden, we see, oh, you know, when I initially sold this to this customer, I wasn't quite sure about this piece, but now I understand how we're going to deliver that. Great. I'm excited. But of course, wonder alone, insight alone is not an innovation. It's not an outcome. It's not the solution. So that's where we go to work, the fourth W. So we have to do some work to put that insight into action. And, you know, we roll our sleeves up in a couple days, weeks, months later, depending on what the project is or the process is. We achieve another win. And this win is even bigger than the first win, which of course is immediately followed by worry, right? And so on is the process of growth.
I love it. I love it. I really do commend your book to people. It's not a long read, and listening to it on Audible, you've got your voice. I just think it's so worthwhile. Now, look, at the Centre for Optimism, we started off 10 years ago looking at why Australians had become so bleak about leadership. And we spent 2 years interviewing people, and at the end, Bill George from Harvard said, "The problem's not the problem of leadership. You guys are pretty good." And 6 months later, I worked out, it was sort of a eureka moment, my wonder and my worry. I worked out the problem was not the problem of leadership. The problem was the problem of pessimism. And so we've spent 8 years now asking people this question: what makes you optimistic? And we've literally thousands and thousands of answers. And almost unless people answer it with one word, like you did with yes, almost all of them are completely different, reflecting people's life experiences. But in a really ambitious thing, a bit like your laws, we have synthesized 10 years of research to this: optimism is the answer to life's most pressing questions. Optimism is the answer to life's most pressing questions. What do you reckon?
Interesting. I like the way that go. Well, okay. So I'm going to go back to the question you asked me at the beginning. What is it that makes you optimistic, right? And I think when we step out, so I was kind of answering that from a personal perspective, and you're asking this from more of the macro kind of global perspective. And I'll give you another one word answer to that: history. If you really are a student of history, you will see how far the world has come. Now, does that mean that we are in the perfect place? Of course not. Does that mean that we don't still have war and hate and disease, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But if you really objectively, honestly, apolitically look at the trajectory of human history, it always gets better. It really does. And right now we have what feels like some intractable problems. We've got climate change. We've got nuclear threats. We've got all this stuff, which it looks like, oh my gosh, how are we ever going to come out on the right side of this? But again, if you look back through history, generations of people over and over again ask themselves the same question. You know, in medieval times, you have to imagine most people were wondering, how do we ever end up coming out of this, right? And of course, it led to the Renaissance. After in the midst of World War II, like, this is it. This is how it all ends. But it didn't. And so that's where I am a student of history, and that's where I find my optimism. So I,
Brilliant.
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. I often, in all my speeches, I quote an English Middle Ages mystic, Mother Julian of Norwich,
Okay.
whose book Revelations is the oldest surviving book in English by a woman. And in it is a single sentence, which is the stuff of poetry. Oxford University did a new choral piece on her 650th birthday last year. She said, "All shall be well. All shall be well. All manner of things shall be well." And I often joke, I say, if she'd lived 650 years, she would have written that Harvard Medical School definition of optimism, a belief that good things will happen and that things will work out in the end. And Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel laureate who died last year, he said this: optimistic people play a disproportionate role in shaping our lives.
Interesting.
Yeah, so your
Optimism.
question of history, just imagine who was the first woman who had to taste the purple berries or the orange mushrooms? We must be the descendants of the people who experimented. And I did the National Geographic genetic test, and my male ancestors went out towards Mongolia. Some of them went to Japan, some came across northern Siberia. And my marker ends up on the Baltic Sea. But the
Interesting.
National Geographic map of where that marker must have traveled said these men and women were real adventurers.
So, interesting that my very first book, called The Impulse Factor, again, this was like 15, I don't know, 18 years ago now, was about that. And, it's funny, until this very moment, Victor, I had never thought about that's probably where this worldview of mine got its foundation, because I was studying, it was The Impulse Factor, and it was based on genetic research and personality research, kind of showing how why some people are more impulsive than other people. And I kind of rebranded them as potential seekers and risk managers. And again, we can trace it back to, just like you did, 40,000 years ago, even further. The people that were, optimistic, for lack of a different term, they were the ones that decided, you know what, maybe we should leave Africa and see what else is out there. And we're descendants of those people. And again, but if you don't believe it, and I think this is where the kind of the crux of it comes down to, if you don't believe it, then you prove yourself right. It's the self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't believe there's a better way out there, you won't look for it and you won't find it.
It's often
Right?
attributed to Ford, the motor car guy, who says the
Yeah.
man who thinks he can and the man who thinks he can't are both right.
Are both right. That's right.
Yeah. So
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, you do a lot of work with corporates and the like, and University of Sydney Business School published a report in October called The Optimism Effect. And they crunched 20 years of OECD data, the most advanced countries' data. And they said that optimism is the key to country and company productivity and innovation and capital formation. So, in other words, optimism is a comparative advantage for both the company and the country. And when I think of optimism, I always think of Silicon Valley and California, I mean, at the moment, they're going through tough times around LA, but the reason it's the seventh biggest economy on earth is that creativity.
Yeah, definitely. And occasionally it gets a bad name, So we have you have the kind of like the unicorn founder that overstepped their bounds a little bit, maybe oversold the promise, but like they're, they're fewer and farther between. The bulk of them, you're right, it's the people that believe, again, there's a better way to do this, a better way to do that. They really do drive progress in the economy and of course in our world. And I, like you said, I work with a lot of corporations, and if I break this down to kind of a more micro level of the individual company or maybe the individual person in the company, one of the things that I've kind of made it my mission to debunk is we say often in corporations, change is hard. Okay. And it's just like it's this sort of throwaway phrase that we just, anytime we talk about change, we talk about how change is hard. And not a year goes by when you don't read an article in some business magazine that says the brutal fact is 70% of all change efforts fail. Okay. It's been talked about for 30 years now, and there is zero evidence to support it. Zero.
Someone
But
at
it.
McKinsey said it, therefore it must be true.
Yeah, right. And and actually, well, I won't bore you with all the details, but it was written by a guy, Michael Hammer, who wrote this famous book in the 90s, and he mentioned it, and in the book he says, our unscientific estimate is that 50 to 75% of re-engine 70% of re-engineering efforts fail. And that all of a sudden just took on a life of its own, and everybody interpreted that as 70% change. Michael Hammer himself, afterward, like 3 years later, was like, I've been misquoted. That's not, I said re-engineering, one specific kind of change. I said 50 to 70%, not 70. And it was based on our best guess, right? Not even a scientific study on it. But I bring that up to say it is the death knell for so many. What could have been transformation efforts in a corporation, because already it sets us off on this path of this isn't going to work. There's a 3 out of 4 chance that this is going to fail because that's just the odds that are stacked against us. And so the first little glimmer that something didn't go right, this project was supposed to be done on this day, and this day came and went, and it's not done yet. All of a sudden, everybody's like, oh, that's it. That's the canary in the coal mine. We're just going to become another number. But the optimist, to your point of what you mentioned earlier, of us being influenced by optimists, the optimists are the ones who will say, no, but look at those 3 other projects that are still on time. And look at how, yeah, this one fell behind, but look at all the progress we made. And even if we push it back a week, it's still tremendous progress, right? And they're always the ones like kind of righting the ship from a rationality perspective, because lots of people think they're being real when they're actually being pessimists. They're paying 3 times more attention to what could go wrong rather than what could go right.
I'm on the board of a water utility, and our blokes brought a project to us for innovation, and the board accepted it and accepted the expenditure. And I said, and the guy said, "Oh, look, this could all go wrong." And I said, "Well, if it goes wrong, we at the board have accepted responsibility." And 6 months later, he said to me, "If there was one thing that gave me confidence, it was that sentence. You know, we know you're giving it a crack. We know it's uncertain, but the board's happy to authorize you to have a crack at it." And I think that's the role of the leader, isn't it? You know, that you don't want to control it all, but you want to take responsibility when you authorize someone to have a crack.
Well, what you gave them there to use the term now is psychological safety. By you saying that, you created an environment of psychological safety. So of course, now they feel free to go and do their work and do what they know how to do, right?
Our next podcast, I'm going to ask you to talk about psychological safety, because I think if there's one thing that drives me nuts in Australia is now our excessive commitment to safety. You know, I drove 1 kilometre from my house yesterday and I passed 8 traffic attendants with stop-go signs who'd created a traffic jam, and they were being paid $150,000 a year to stand on a quiet suburban street. So I'll come back to that. Psychosocial hazards and psychological safety. I, coming from a family of refos and people who had to escape under bombing, you know, I understand life isn't safe all the time.
Well, you know, and what's interesting about that paradox is, and so I'm working with a lot of manufacturing companies recently, and they, you know, by law and whatever reason, they have to say like safety is number one, you know, and not just say it, mean it, right? Because they got to minimize workplace accidents, et cetera. But the interesting thing about psychological safety, the ironic thing is, it's kind of like it's almost the opposite of the way we normally use the term safety. When we say psychological safety, what we're saying is we're giving people permission to take risks, to do things that are dangerous. Now, granted, not in like a physical safety way, but in a, like you said, this leader, like to go try things, right? Providing the psychological safety says it's okay to be dangerous, basically.
Yeah, that interesting. The value in the corporate strategy is be brave for positive results. So not be safe for positive results, be brave for positive results. But we'll come back to that because this is I was having a wonderful argument with our organizational psych in one of the public service departments I do some work in. So we'll come back to that because that's a big,
All
big,
right, great.
big, big topic. Can I go to a really big topic because we're running out of time? Because you've been very generous,
Please.
but I want to go to the world. And there's a singer, I don't know if you know him, Michael Franti, but I like him and I like his music. But I like what he said. And I'll give you the full quote. I believe the great battle that's taking place in the world isn't between left and right, it's between cynicism and optimism. There are people who believe it's possible to create a better life and a better world. When we lose that sentence, optimism is when we quit, when we give up. And I don't know if you watched the coronation of King Charles III, but there was this spectacular woman in a blue gown, and her name was Penny Mordaunt, and she was the first woman to ever carry the king's sword. And she
Interesting.
almost became Prime Minister of England, but lost her seat in the last election. And she said, "The fault line in politics at the moment is not between left and right, but between optimists and pessimists. We need optimists for the next tough shift." And then the other guy I admire a lot is the president of Singapore, Tharman. And he said that the greatest public policy problem in the world is the collapse of optimism in the West. And if we want to deal with climate change, if we want to deal with water crises and the like, we've got to create the case for optimism. So what do you reckon? I mean, your book, your chapter is part of the world charged to do it. Can we do it?
Yeah, I think in this global context or in this political context, I absolutely agree. And I think the idea with cynicism, when you play that out and you say, okay, so what will happen if cynics get control? Well, what happens is isolationism. Right. So, like, if you believe that the world is a dark and dangerous place and it's only getting darker and more dangerous, what do? You batten down the hatches, you build up bigger defenses, and you close up. Right. And we do this, you know, at the macro, you know, country level, and we do it at the organizational level as well. And that's when we stop innovating, when we kind of like, nope, let's just dig the moat deeper, which I know maybe there's some value in that in strategy, but it's like we stop thinking about what the next thing is. We lose touch with the customers. We lose touch with the opportunities that are out there, and we just hold on. We just start white knuckling the way things already are. And of course, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The world then does become dangerous. We do become at risk of failure because we've stopped seeing opportunities.
I will call you to action as we develop further. Now, we've already shared what one of my little tips, which is get rid of the question, "How are you?" and replace it with "What's been the best thing in your day?" As you're advocating your agile optimism and you're helping corporations and individuals become more optimistic, what are your top two or three tricks for being more infectiously optimistic?
Yeah, I think number one is expect falling apples. Okay, it's a really simple idea, but start out each day not from a place of I'm worried about this happening. I'm concerned that, you know, I'm not going to show up right in this environment, et cetera. And that's that's where my mind wants to start every day. I think that's normal for many of us. But instead, if we look at it and say, I wonder what falling apples I'm going to see today. So rather than I worry about this meeting that maybe I'm not prepared for, I wonder what insights, what falling apples I'm going to see in this meeting. And I think it's just a really simple way to switch gears in your brain. So expect insights. That's probably my number one, and that's what makes everything else possible. The other thing I would say that's really helpful is to ask yourself this question. In 10 years, when I look back on this moment, what do I want to remember doing or not doing today? And just again, that simple opening up in perspective. And I recommend this to my clients. I do it myself all the time. I have have it posted on my wall right here in 10 years. And I really think about that, like try and go deep. So I have four children, and right now they are 17, 16, 12, and 9. There's a lot to keep track of, right? But I think about, okay, in 10 years, I'm going to be this old. And I'm not going to tell you how old that is, but my kids are going to be 27, 26. And I start going down that path so I can really visualize what the world will look like. And it opens up your perspective and helps you see that this thing that I'm a little worried about, I'm not even going to remember. What win or lose, goes right or wrong, there's no way I'm going to even have a memory of this 10 years from now. So how important really is it? Versus this thing, boy, I can look back on this for the rest of my life and be so proud, so happy that I did this. And so I think just those two things will open your eyes to possibilities that you never really noticed before, but are right under your nose every single day.
Yeah, that's brilliant. One of the things I originally taught people to do this one-on-one, but now people love doing it in a group, is that exercise, My Best Self, where you
Okay.
imagine yourself in 5 years' time and you write a journal article, a journal diary of that day, what your best day in 5 years looks like. And it keeps coming back into your head. And I did it at a chamber of commerce. They asked me to do it and I had lots of time. And
Yeah.
They said, oh, we want to share it. And they went around the room. 54 of the 55 people in the room shared it. And
Wow.
people would say, I'll come with you. You know, it was, I'm going to do this. And, you know, and that was only 2 years ago. A number of the things have already come true
Well, you know, and
because I did it together.
I think it has two values. I think for a long time we've talked about that idea of like, imagine your future self, and we've thought about it from kind of like a like you need to have a vision, you need to have something to shoot for, to aim for, which is totally important. But now in the last 10 or 20 years, this flourishing of research on psychological distancing shows us that even if the vision doesn't ever come true, it just elevates our perspective in this moment. It eases our anxieties. It makes us feel more optimistic, more confident, and so it just puts us in a better place. Even if you change your vision tomorrow, it still has that same now effect on it, right? So it's such a powerful exercise that you did with them. I can't believe that 54 out of 55 people actually shared it though.
Yeah, and some of them
Kudos
were
to
funny.
you.
Like, you know, one guy said, look, yeah, my business is going to be sold, or I'm going to have retired, you know, and I'm going to be on an island in Tahiti. You know, and someone else said, well, I'm going to be with you on that island in Tahiti too. Well, of course, they haven't waited till the business is sold. They've gone to Tahiti.
In their mind. So now they're optimistic, right?
It's a good one. It's a good one. The other one I
It
love
is.
is just the simple one of just smiling and saying hello to everyone. You know, you walk down so many corporate corridors now and people have got their iPad in front of me or their iPhone in front of them and just ignoring those serendipitous moments, speaking to a stranger. And I've developed this habit of the older man, I think. I walk past and someone pauses and I then start a conversation. And that notion of what you can learn from a stranger.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll take that one step further. So So again, there's another advantage to that. So one is just that it's like it greases the wheels of the social interaction, the collaboration, and the who knows what may come of this, right? It definitely does that. The other thing it does is just simply forcing yourself to smile tricks your brain into thinking that you are happy and confident in that moment. So one thing I recommend to people, even if you're by yourself and nobody else is around, is you do the pencil trick. So you put a pencil in your mouth, way back in your teeth, and you hold it there for 2 minutes. And researchers have actually found, Amy Cuddy at Harvard actually is the one that did most of this. If you do this, when people do that for 2 minutes, they end those 2 minutes feeling more confident, more empowered, more optimistic, because your brain feels a smile. You can't, when you put that pencil in your mouth, it makes you smile. It makes your teeth come out, makes your lips go up, and your brain senses that smile and it starts creating a narrative about why we must be happy in this moment, why we must feel good in this moment. And so it's like you're tricking your own brain by forcing a smile.
I might do that while I'm smelling my tequila sunrise rose this morning. It's a yellow rose with orange highlights and a beautiful aroma. So I might take the pen out with me as well and smile at that rose. That's my next job this morning. So, lastly, how can listeners best stay in touch with you, follow your work, and learn more about the ideas you're sharing?
Well, I would say first and foremost, if you're on LinkedIn, that's a great place. That's probably where I am the most active on a daily basis. So look me up on LinkedIn, Nick Tassler. And then, of course, NickTassler.com is the home base for all things Nick Tassler. I send out a newsletter every couple of weeks. You can subscribe to the list there, get a free book when you do that. So those are the two places, LinkedIn and NickTassler.com.
And if you're going to Puerto Rico, ignore what's been in the political debate. Go and
Yeah.
visit Nick.
Ignore the blackouts, ignore the hurricane threats. It's fine.
I live in Australia. We have 19 of the 20 most poisonous animals on Earth. And in fact,
And
you'd love the
it's a
meme when
beautiful
Donald
country.
Trump was talking about invading places. Of course, they said, well, of course, Australia has no guns. And we said, I know, but we've got the biggest crocodiles, the most poisonous snakes.
The last place you want to find yourself armed or not, out in the outback, right?
Exactly. Well, of course, Crocodile Dundee showed us that. Well, thank you, Nick. It's been wonderful to spend time with you. Your book is fabulous. I think suggest anyone who wants to read something good on a plane, whether it's through your earbuds on Audible, or whether it's on a Kindle, really worth doing. Nick Tassler, thank you.
Thank you, Victor.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of That Optimism Man podcast. We'd love you to stay engaged. We'd love you to be involved and share your thoughts. So go to the Center for Optimism website, just Google it, Center for Optimism, and you'll be able to sign up with a form there. And also, if you'd like to just follow the work that I do and connect on LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook, they're the ones I mainly use. You'd be very welcome to do so. So, today, get out there, say hello to people, smile at everyone, maybe ask someone what's brought them joy today. And if you're leading a meeting today or tomorrow or later this week, maybe change the agenda and make the first question, what's brought you joy this week and what are you looking forward to for next week or even next year?